Hello and welcome to Great Lives. For 67 years, the remains of Arthur Wharton lay in a pauper's grave in Edlington, South Yorkshire. There was nothing to tell the world that this was once the fastest man over 100 yards, or that he was the first black man to play professional football. My guest this week is the former England footballer, Viv Anderson, MBE. Viv's clubs included Nottingham Forest, Arsenal and Manchester United, and on a cold Wembley night in November 1978, Viv made history when he became the first black player to represent England in a full international match. Viv, you've chosen Arthur Wharton as your great life. Why?
When somebody asked me to do this programme many months ago, to think about who I'd choose, there was lots of obviously big sportsmen that I admire, but I'd met a friend of mine and introduced me to Arthur Wharton. I said, Arthur who, initially, and subsequently I checked up and I opened the Arthur Wharton Museum in Preston, and subsequently I've been involved ever since.
Joining us to flesh out the life of Arthur Wharton is Sean Campbell, director of the Arthur Wharton Foundation. Sean, just in 30 or 40 words, who was Arthur Wharton and how did he end up playing football in the north of England?
Arthur Wharton came to England to study as a Methodist preacher. Whilst in England, he was seen running across the forecourt of Cleveland College, Darlington, by the then trainer of Darlington Cricket and Football Club, a chap called Manny Hebron. And he saw a fantastic turn of speed and thought, wow, this is a chap that we can take under our wings and turn into a great sportsman. And in actual fact, that is what happened. Arthur went on to become the world's first professional black football player. He became the world's first 100-yard record holder, professional cricketer, British cycling champion, and he also played rugby. The man was a phenomenon.
Tell us a bit, Sean, about his ancestry and his origins.
Well, Arthur Wharton was born in what was then called the Gold Coast, which is where we know today as Ghana. He's from fairly noble ancestry, you know. He was an aristocrat. His uncle, F.C. Grant, ran the Ghanaian Times, as it
was
called.
That was a white man, I assume, was it?
He was mixed race, yeah. Of mixed origin. His father, incidentally, came from Grenada in the Caribbean,
yeah.
Went to Grenada. And it was there where he met his lovely wife, Annie, and they got married. She was a Fante princess. And ironically, of course, the lineage, the parental lineage, is both from his parents, Scottish Ghanaian. So, I mean, that's effectively what makes up Arthur Wharton's genetic heritage.
And the family were missionaries?
The family were missionaries. His father, Arthur, came from Grenada in the Caribbean to Ghana to further his Methodist preachings. And as you'll understand, that it was quite natural in those days for the son or the daughter of somebody studying such things to continue that line and to pursue a further career in the ministry.
And they were a reasonably well-to-do family. He didn't start life penniless. He was sent over to this country to receive a good private education, I think, Viv.
Yes, England was notably where you get a good education. Mm. And he came over here and I think, yeah. Was he actually found at Darlington Football Club, or where was he initially found?
He began his sporting career in this country, actually in the West Midlands at a place called Cannock. And they had two teams. You had Cannock and you had Cannock White Cross. Mm. And that's really where he kind of cut his teeth. Well, I mean, with an name like, yes, of course.
So he went to the black country.
He went to the black country, as it were, up north. And he came to Darlington, you know, and it was really in Darlington where he made his name as a sportsman. Mm. And this chap could run 100 yards in 10 seconds dead in 1886.
And he ended up being a goalkeeper. How does that work out?
Well, the ironic thing there was that being a goalkeeper was one thing. You had to be very tough. You needed somebody of a strong character of mind to be in goal. You could be harassed, harangued, bullied, hustled off the ball. Often, you know, the onrushing forwards would barge into the goalkeeper so that the teammates could score. And this was all legal in the day, you see. So you needed somebody who had that presence about them. Arthur would occasionally, of course, run out of goal and score two or three goals a game because nobody could catch him.
Let me ask about the running, Sean. I was a not-too-good long-distance runner, so I'm kind of sorry he went into football at all because that was an amazing record. How did he make money as a runner? How did you in the end of the 19th century.
You ran in handicapped races and you were paid for running. It's very much similar to where you are today. You know, you put on your shirt for a club or a country and you get a guest appearance fee. But you see, what Arthur did, he was quite clever. He was quite aware of his own kind of stature in society. I mean, at the end of 1886, you know, the guy was a nationally known person rather than a locally known person.
How did you get first noticed, Viv? Did you know your own talent? Did others encourage you?
I played football from a very, very early age. So if you speak to my parents, every opportunity I got to play football, I played.
Where was that?
In Nottingham, born and bred in Nottingham. Mm. So when I was 15, I was chosen to have a trial at Manchester United. And there's Best Lawn Charlton. So you can imagine in those days, they're on the next pitch to us. So your eyes are agog then. So I was asked to go back with them forwards for a year. They finally, after that year, they said to me, well, I don't think you're going to quite make it at Manchester United. So I went back to Nottingham. I got a job as a silk screen printer for 5 weeks, and then Forrest saw me play.
That was enough.
Well, Forrest said, come and play for our youth team. So I went to play for the youth team one Wednesday afternoon, and they said, we want to sign you at 17. And I went back, got rid of my job, and went back and made my debut when I was 17. So all's well that ends well, that's to say.
Arthur Warden, already by his early 20s, had a choice of three careers. His family wanted to be a missionary, for which he'd begun training. He knew he was going to be a champion runner, and he was showing huge promise in football too, so he had a choice. Did you feel, Viv, at any stage in your career that you had a choice, there were other things that you could equally do?
Academically, I wasn't the brightest. I think I got CSEs or GCSEs or whatever they were. Football was always my great love, but you never know what's around the corner. My parents used to say, listen, you've got to get yourself a job. You've had your football a little bit now. Get yourself a job and earn yourself a living.
Do they still say that?
Yes. Yes, on the way down on the train, she did say that to me, my mother. But yes, it was... obviously, rejection at 16 is a big thing, and nowhere near as bad as what Arthur had to go through, you know? Mm. So
Sean, Arthur was routinely referred to as Darkie Warden by the Victorian press. He got called nigger perfectly routinely as well. I suppose the word was in routine use in those days. Well, a local paper said he was by no means a representative Englishman, which I suppose was at least statistically true in the 1880s. Did the press treat him as a curiosity? And were those references denigratory, or were they simply treating him as different, exotic?
I think those phrases were there as part of the kind of scientific exploration of the races in Victorian England.
Yeah.
You know, where they tended to look at the difference between people who were black and white. You know, did black people have the same mental capacity as white people? What was their physical prowess? How did these differ? I mean, that was quite an undertaking in that day. And against that backdrop, Arthur, of course, was going to be scrutinised. Of that, I have absolutely no doubt. But the overriding feelings towards Arthur and these kind of terminologies that you came out with, I mean, they're still there today for players. Just 4 years ago, my father's from Barbados. He's black. My mother's white. I'm of particularly light complexion. But just 4 years ago, on my return from Barbados, when I turned out for my local team, I shouldn't be playing at the age of 48, I know, but I can't resist it. I was received with a number of derogatory remarks, which were the very remarks you've just actually said there, the word nigger, the word wog, I was called Aborigine, and all of this was just 4 years ago, Matthew. And when you consider the colour of my skin, very much lighter than, say, for example, that of Viv, you become acutely aware that, wow, what must have Arthur have gone through 100-odd years earlier?
Well, you know, look, when I started. I started in 73, 74. Never heard of seeing a black face at all.
Did you have to endure the shouts and the abuse and the rest?
Early on, yeah. I remember going to Newcastle from your neck of the woods and playing Newcastle. And one of my second, I think it was my second game, it was a cup tie. And Malcolm McDonald and John Tudor and people like that. And I went out to look at the pitch with the rest of the team, and they were booing and swearing and all these terminologies that we said earlier. And I went back to my manager and said, I don't think I could play today. And he says, you get yourself out there.
Who was your manager?
My manager was Dave McKay at the time. It was a great player, and he said, get yourself out there and get yourself playing, because you have to show them your ability. That's why I've picked you, and you can't let them get you down or underperform tonight, because I need you.
Did it get you down?
No, from that day on, I think a couple of weeks later, Brian Clough came. We go to Carlisle, and I'm subbed this day, and Mr. Clough says, Anderson, because he never called you your first name, he says, Anderson, go and warm up. So I go and warm up, come back, and I sit next to him. Within 2 minutes, and he says to me, I thought I told you to warm up. I says, I have done. He said, but they're throwing bananas, pears, they're throwing everything at me out there. He says, well, get back out there and get two pears and a banana for me. That's a true story. So his way of saying, get yourself out there and get yourself back out there because you're going to go on and play and not bother what other people are doing or throwing at you. So it was his way of lightening the atmosphere or for an 18-year-old lad, get yourself out there and get me two bananas and a pear.
Of course, you can contrast that story with the story of Paul Cannavill. I mean, it was 1978, of course, when Viv Anderson turned out as the first black player for England. But it wasn't until 1981 when the first black player actually played for Chelsea, and that was Paul Cannavill. His tale is a very similar story to Viv's when he went out for that first game and he was running up and down the touchline, warming up, as his manager says, get out there and get warmed up. He was met with bananas, racist abuse, and it affected Paul, obviously, perhaps in a different way than it did with Viv.
Is that at home?
His own fans, yes. And this is what he found devastating. People, I think, threw bananas on the pitch and things like this, and said things like, if the effing nigger scores, then it doesn't count. All of these kind of things, get the nigger off the pitch. And this sent Paul into a dramatic decline some years later. He got heavily involved in drugs, in alcohol. His story was incredibly harrowing, but it's an incredibly important part of the culture and the black history of football in this country.
Just knocked him right off the road, really.
Completely knocked him off the road. I don't think he had, in the day, his biggest ally, I think, was Pat Nevin, of all people, who one day walked into a changing room and heard some kind of racist abuse towards Paul and just knocked that on the head immediately and said, we're not going to have this. And I think that he provided an incredible pillar of support for Paul.
Whether or not you meant to, Viv, you've changed English footballing history on that night in November 1978. It was a big deal in the press, probably for you. Did you kind of half wish that you were the second rather than the first? Did you want all that weight of history on your shoulders?
First and foremost, I was a footballer trying to make a living. And to be picked for your country was nothing but a great honour for me at the time. And I just wanted to play well.
On the halfway line, Anderson takes the throw. Finds Latchford, but his control is sadly lacking, really. And that's been, for me, the biggest difference between these two sides on a difficult pitch. The first time control of these Czech players has been exemplary, where England's control has been so often lacking. And the Czechs coming forward again strongly. The ball played across England's penalty area, and the one man whose control has always been superb for England, Peter Shilton, goes down on his elbows on that hard surface and saves them once again. So we're halfway through this second half. It's still England 0, Czechoslovakia 0.
I've been chosen because I could play particularly well in a certain position at that given time, and it wasn't about the weight of expectation, or clearly there was a weight of expectation because my parents were interviewed, I get a telegram from the Queen, Elton John, people, things like that, that doesn't happen to the normal person making their debut. So obviously at the time I was just thrilled to be in the squad. When the manager told me I was going to play, I was absolutely delighted. And then after that, it was about not making a mistake, not falling over, not costing the team a victory, and try and do myself justice.
Loose ball from Curry, but it's picked up by Latchford. And Latchford laying it back to Curry, out to Anderson. And Anderson starts to gallop forward now, halfway inside the Czechoslovak half. He's got Curry outside him, and he'll feed Curry. And Curry will belt it across. Good save, and it's in the net, and England have scored!
Arthur Warden was quite a performer, wasn't he? He was even a performer in goal. The business of swinging from the...
He used to swing from the band and dip it so low, of course, that the ball would go over the crossbar, because it was quite a flexible crossbar in the day. But also he would catch the ball between his legs. And he would crouch into the corner of the goal, let the onrushing forwards come forward, and then just do a spectacular dive. But this was also kind of his Achilles heel, because it was interpreted, that kind of action that he took was interpreted in a number of ways. One, was he a safe pair of hands for England? Well, if we look at today's contemporary, and we look at David James, for example, I think he's a fantastic goalkeeper. He is flawed, however, and we know that as football fans. But I think he's flawed in the right way, much like Arthur. He's more secure than he is insecure. But if you take away the element of character that he has, I think you spoil the man.
Football News and Athletic Journal of Arthur Wharton's day said this about him: is the darkie's pate too thick for it to dawn upon him that between the posts is no place for a skylark? That, I guess, is the sort of prejudice that you're talking about. Not just racial, but prejudice against anyone who performs.
Precisely. And also, these antics were seen as animal characteristics. Therefore, they would associate that with him being black. So they would be going back to that kind of scientific approach of the Victorian era, if you like, you know.
Yeah, the Encyclopaedia Britannica of 1884. It states authoritatively that, quote, no full-blooded Negro has ever been distinguished as a man of science, a poet or an artist. It's quite hard to put ourselves now into the mental frame of the era in which Arthur Wharton lived and prospered.
It's incredible, really.
It is.
That's why I was so taken by the man himself, you know. As I said in my opening gambit, you know, I could have chosen a million people. And when you look at his life and you study his life,
it's just remarkable, isn't it?
Absolutely incredible.
It's remarkable.
You're listening to Great Lives. My guest this week is the former England football international, Viv Anderson, who's chosen the life of the first black professional player, Arthur Wharton. Joining us is the director of the Arthur Wharton Foundation, Sean Campbell. Sean, Arthur Wharton was a successful sprinter. He was also apparently a talented cricketer in the summer months. He was a waged footballer for much of his sporting career. Yet in the middle of this success, or was it after this success, that he applied to join the Gold Coast Civil Service? That would have been the colonial service, I suppose. Do you think he was unhappy in England?
There came a point where he started to realise that, you know, he'd reached the end of his sporting kind of prowess, and I think he sought a return back to the Gold Coast, perhaps in the hope that he could work for his uncle, F.C. Grant, who was incredibly wealthy.
What age would he be there, Sean?
He will have been 30 years old, somewhere around there, when he packed up, I guess. But, you know, I mean, Arthur's life ended in poverty. He went on to become a colliery worker, a miner.
I want to come on to that in a moment. His private life was a bit of a disaster, I think, Viv.
Don't look at me, Matthew. You're looking at the wrong person when you're asking that question.
That was an inquisitive rather than accusatory step. Yes, tell us, Sean.
Yes. His private life. Well, I mean, Arthur was... Arthur Wharton became an alcoholic, you know. He ran a pub or two.
He fathered two children by his wife's sister as well.
Allegedly, yes. Well, this is the thing. I mean, I met with Sheila, absolutely wonderful lady, Arthur Wharton's great-great-grandniece, just a couple of weeks ago in Rotherham, which is where she lives. And I was privileged to have a look at Arthur's Bible from 1882 there with his own handwriting and so forth in it. And whilst there, I walked into the living room and saw a photograph on the back wall, and it was of her grandson. And as soon as I looked, I thought, that's Arthur Wharton. And yet, there should be no bloodline on that side of the family. So then, of course, Sheila went on to tell me that, you know, when Arthur had died, or when her mother had died, they'd found a letter that spoke very affectionately of Arthur. And there's some feelings now, of course, that this, of course, was Arthur Wharton's offspring.
That was the father.
Yeah. He's known to have had a number of illegitimate children, I believe. I wouldn't like to speculate how many.
He travelled a long way in almost every sense from his missionary origins, didn't he?
He really did.
He played football in his declining years and ran a pub, Viv. What is it about ageing footballers and pubs? It seems it's almost the worst thing to be.
It was a given in when they finished in early 80s, you know, late 80s. You played your football career and somebody comes along and says, hey, go on, can you manage this pub? A couple of friends of mine did do that. I didn't get into that, I must admit. It's easy being the other side of the bar because running a pub is not very easy to do. But it was one of those things that footballers used to go into, running pubs and stuff like that. Now they're multimillionaires, they can choose whatever they want to do when they retire.
These days as well, when a once global superstar goes to the dogs, drink or drugs or wives or gambling or whatever, they become as famous for their fall as they were for, infamous is the word, I mean, George Best, Paul Gascoigne, people like that. But Wharton descended not into infamy, but just into total obscurity, as far as I can tell.
That's right.
That's a sign of the day. I mean, it demonstrates that the history of achievers back then were predominantly white, and if you were black or if you were of an ethnic minority, you wouldn't really get a looking. Mm. And you see, this is why this campaign...
Once you fail.
Precisely. And this is why I believe that to see Arthur Wharton honoured appropriately in the form of a statue is critically important. There are no statues of black footballers in this country. If somebody says to me, Sean, why do you think a statue is the most appropriate way to honour Arthur Wharton, I would say this. Viv Anderson has been rewarded with an MBE. The MBE is either in his pocket, or it's at home, or it's framed. Unless you know about Viv Anderson, you're not going to pass it anything in the street that will tell you about him. A public statue offers a different opportunity. If you're walking along with your young children and your young child says, "Hey, Daddy, what's that?" By going and looking, you learn about the history, you learn about the contribution, and you're in touch with public art. It ticks a lot of very important social criteria, particularly in the light of the fact that, you know, the youth of today need to understand that if you achieve, you will be celebrated. And let's start with Arthur Wharton, particularly in the black community.
Which is a great testament, really. I've played professional sport for 19, 20 years. Yeah. Until 3 years ago, I'd never heard of Arthur Wharton.
Which is remarkable.
It is.
I meet professional footballers today, Viv, who've never heard of him.
No. Even in 1978, when I made my debut, nobody mentioned... Arthur Wharton was before you. Nobody ever mentioned
him. And this man, for whom there are now museum collections, and for whom you're collecting money for a statue, after his career was over, after his pub had failed, after he was drinking too much, he spends the last 15 years of his life, if I'm right, as a colliery haulage hand in Yorkshire.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, that was...
Which means what?
Well, it means that he was working for the mines. He actually went, you know, on the 1926 NUM march. He was a big supporter of that. And, yeah, he lived... That last 15 years must have been a very trying time for him, particularly if you consider, as we touched on earlier, he was married to one woman and probably in love with the sister. Or, you know, and he had all that to contend with. The loss of his stature. I mean, one remarkable thing, of course, if it wasn't for the fantastic work of Football Unites Racism Divides, you know, who actually erected a headstone in honour of Arthur Wharton back in 1997, we may still be looking to learn about Arthur Wharton. But the amazing thing was, when I saw Arthur's Bible a couple of weeks ago, I was told this tale of when they went to unveil the headstone, the priest turned up, and he said, "OK, Sheila, what would you like me to read out?" And she said, "I didn't bring anything." So he said, "Well, I didn't bring anything. I thought you were going to bring something." She said, "The only thing I've got is Arthur's Bible." So the priest said, "Let's open it at random and read whatever's there." Good idea. So they opened the Bible, and there, underlined in Arthur's own hand, was the date that he'd done the underlining. There was the year that he'd done the underlining. And the passage was Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7. And it went along the lines of, "Lest I be exalted above all others, the Lord put a thorn in my flesh from Satan." Basically,
oh yes, thorn in my side.
Yes, and it was to say, you know, do not become big-headed. Do not exalt yourself above others because of your cult. It was such a poignant read. And when I was shown this a couple of weeks ago, to my amazement, when I looked at the dates, the year that this was underlined in his own hand, it was 1884, the year he came to Darlington.
The World Cup begins on African soil quite soon. You're heavily involved trying to bring the tournament to English shores in a few years' time. Are you confident that the racism that blighted Arthur Wharton's career has been, well, no one would say obliterated, but do you think it's on its way out now, and permanently so?
We don't want people like that in stadiums now. They're taken out of the stadium very quickly. It's when we go abroad, it's still permanent abroad.
Yeah,
we go to
absolutely.
The Baltic States. You know, England went a couple of years ago. You know, we're racially abused, you know. And I always go back to the tale of Thierry Henry when he was playing for Arsenal. He was talking about if he gets any racial abuse, he's going to walk off a football field. Now, people are going there to watch him play and watch him perform. They pay a lot of money, and it'd be a crying shame if a small minority of people spoil it for everybody else. To answer your question, I think in this country, I think we've got a house in order. I think we've still got a lot to do. I think the FIFA's still got a lot to do, because the people who are perpetrating these things have been fined a pittance. It's ridiculous, bordering on ridiculous, you know. £14,000. If it was a lot of money, people would stand up and take notice. If it was £1 million, I think the associations, whatever country it would be in, would say, "Hang on a minute, we can't have these people in these football grounds because it's costing us money." And they, you know, in this day and age, money is quite tight. So I think it's got to come from the powers that be.
Final question. Do you think Arthur Wharton, as you imagine him, could have foreseen these days, could have foreseen people like you and careers like yours? Would it have been imaginable to him that the world would change in that way?
It was quite imaginable for me in 1978, when you think now, in 2010, you go to most football clubs and you'll see a black face playing. There was, as I said earlier, there was three or four players when I first started. Now, there's the whole host. Is every football club has got a black face. So it was difficult to predict and see how the future would be, and I'm still amazed to this day. So I think Arthur would be quite pleased and quite happy.
My thanks to Viv Anderson, who chose the life of the 19th century black athlete and footballer Arthur Wharton, and to Sean Campbell. Goodbye.